Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor exists to help people find their way back to God. This week, Pastor Tim kicks off our new series that's called Let Me Tell You a Story. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Tim.
And if you have a Bible, we are going to be in Genesis chapter 22. Genesis chapter 22. And let me just say, it is good to be back. A little over a week ago, so it was last week, Friday, Jeremy and I got back with our group of brand new friends. Many of them we were friends with before, but the friendship gets way deeper. And we got back from Turkey and Greece, where we did 12 days of biblical study. And it was an incredible time. Honestly, I recognized my soul needed it. It was a lot of work to put those kinds of things together. It's a lot of teaching on the ground, a lot of walking. Right, team? A lot of walking. But I recognize over the last several months, so much of what has consumed my time has been the business side of church, and the legal stuff and bank stuff and all of that stuff that thankfully there are really good volunteers that I'm mostly just kind of standing alongside of, but they're doing most of the work. But it has felt like that, and I really needed to be a pastor again and to teach the Bible and to pray with people and have people pray for me and with me. And so thanks for granting that space. Those of you who weren't with us, thanks for granting that space so that we could do that. It is also good to be back, though. We had a great time. Something happens when you spend, we were 9 days on the ground, 12 days total. When you spend that much time unplugged from your phone and walking outside in nature, Turkey and Greece are beautiful. They're like stunning things to see. And thinking together about the early church, specifically Paul and John's journeys, and what it took for the early church to proclaim Jesus in a culture that honestly looks very similar to ours. The Roman world is very similar. Something happens when you spend that kind of time together and you do that, is really hard to explain and to experience it. But it is good to be back. One of the things I'm always aware of on the flight home is no matter how beautiful the world is, there's really nothing more beautiful than your own bed. Every time I travel anywhere. And so it's good to be back. And this morning we're starting a short little sermon series, a three-week series that we're calling Let Me Tell You a Story. And it is tell with one L, intentionally. So for those of you who have been to Turkey or Greece or Israel with us, this is maybe a word you've bumped into. But a tell, if I can get the next picture, a tell is an artificial mound. And it looks, this one's kind of AI'd, but it looks something like this. It's an artificial mound. You see them everywhere. And what we know is that they're underneath the layer of dirt. There are layers of history and civilization. And so what an archaeologist will do is they'll put their shovel in the ground, and then it's always the question of what layer do we uncover and what layer do we leave behind for future generations. And so because often the way cities were built was if there was an earthquake or another nation conquered, instead of just clearing the rubble, they would just throw some dirt on it because these are massive stone pillars, and they would just rebuild the city on top of it. So you've got layers upon layers. You've got like the Roman layer and the Jesus layer, and then you can go deeper to the David layer and to the Abraham layer. And so what we thought is, let's take three spots and let's metaphorically join the archaeologists and let's put a shovel in the ground and see what story is in the soil and how the location itself becomes like a character in the story. And understanding where something happens actually shifts how we understand the individual story. So we're calling it Let Me Tell You a Story with one L because we thought that was cute, because they're called a tell. But today we're going to be in Genesis 22, and we're going to be spending our time on arguably one of the most important places in the world. Honestly, arguably the most important place in the world. And in Genesis 22, that place is called Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah. And the story of Mount Moriah, the story that takes place here, is one of my favorite stories to teach on. I committed to myself a few years back that it is, I think, such a fundamental story that we probably should teach on it at least every 5 years. And so if you've been with us for a few years, hopefully this is a little bit of refresher. If you're new with us, I just find this story to be incredible. This story, this particular moment, changed how everyone everywhere thought about God. Up until this moment, people thought about God one way, and then this moment disrupts. It's like God recognizes how people are thinking about him and says, okay, this is not good. So it's like he puts his finger on the power button and long holds it until it resets everything. This story is the Great Reset, and it is incredible. However, a warning before we dive in. It has become one of my favorite stories, and at the surface level, it's probably your least favorite story, just at the surface level, and for good reason. The story itself seems really, really messed up. This is one of those stories that if you're reading your Bible, you start in Genesis, and you're going to read your Bible through in a year or whatever, and you get to Genesis 22. This is one of those stories that keeps you up at night and makes you wonder if you should keep reading at all. It's one of those kinds of stories. More than that, some of the most hurtful and destructive messages that have been kind of pushed out, either by the church itself and sometimes by critics of the church, have rooted themselves in this particular story. This story has had so many people stuck in our faith. This is at least top five most problematic texts in the Bible for so many people. And behind this, there is a lie that often gets attached to the story and that this story needs to address. And the lie is that God is out to get us. The lie is that the reason bad things are happening is somehow your fault. You didn't do something. You didn't offer something. It's your fault. The pain you've experienced or that you've watched a loved one experience. Somewhere in there, it's your fault. You didn't have enough faith. You weren't a good enough believer. Or if you've walked beside someone who had an illness and you watched that illness slowly kind of take over their physical health and that lie that it was their fault somewhere, or that God is punishing you for doing something and somewhere in your past you made a mistake and now it's catching up to you and this is God punishing you. I had someone back in the day tell me that it was this story or this theology that caused them to believe that this is why they couldn't get pregnant. And they struggled with infertility or they lost a pregnancy. This is the lie that many believe when a relationship falls apart, this is my fault. This particular lie, there's a lot of money to be made in perpetuating the lie. There's a lot of, because fear sells and fear gets people to do a lot of things. And so there's a lot of money that's behind this particular lie, but it is a lie, it's not true, and it's a misread of the story. Now, to get at that, let's get into the text. The story we're going to read is coming right after a man named Abraham, very early in our Bible, moves to a region known as Canaan in the Bible. Later, it becomes like modern-day Israel's in the same footprint. But God has promised Abraham a couple of things prior to him stepping in. God said, okay, when you step in, I will give you land and I'll give you children. And I'll give you like a legacy. So I'll give you land, children, and a legacy. The problem is once he steps, he leaves home, he steps into the new land, 20 years go by, and he still doesn't own any land, and he still has no children. And the second one's a really big deal to Abraham because he's at this point in his life, he's like 90. He's in his 90s. And so like this idea that like, okay, you're going to have children, but now he's in his 90s. Can you imagine being in your 90s and having a baby? My wife and I were just talking about, like, we have some friends that are, like, she's pregnant, and we're like, can you imagine going back to baby stage? That's such an exhausting stage. Can you imagine, like, if you're Abraham, though, he's 90 years old, it's like, here's a diaper for you, and, like, it's like God had promised him children. Now, you get to chapter 21 in Genesis, and he's given a child, he and Sarah are given a child together, and they name that child Isaac. And they name it Isaac because they name him Isaac because when Sarah's told she's going to have a kid, she laughs. She's like, "That's ridiculous. I'm 90." But they do have a child together. It's a miracle, and they name that little boy Isaac. And then we read this, the very next story, Genesis 22. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham," "Here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you." See how problematic that is already. Here's an artist recreation or artistic recreation of Mount Moriah as Abraham would have known it in his day. We'll look at this picture again, but there was likely some Canaanites on this hill, so it probably wasn't completely barren, but it would look something like that in terms of geography. Hard to picture because now there's a modern-day city on that same region, but it would look something like that in Abraham's day. Verse 3. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and he loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. It's like such a dad thing, right? Like, he's going to carry the dangerous stuff even all the way to the end, knowing what's going to happen. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father." "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and the wood are here," Isaac said, "but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham answered, and I imagine this with tears. Probably put that in there, right? "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and he laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and he took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Don't lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and he took the ram and he sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it is said, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." That's our story. Now, can you see how that's a hard story? Yeah, it's like one of those when you get there. It was a hard story for me. When I was in seminary, I had a professor who said, "I want you to find the most problematic story in the Bible to you, and you're going to do a deep dive on that particular story." And of all the stories in the Bible that are challenging, this was the one I chose. It just felt so primitive. It felt so barbaric. And as a dad, I'm grateful that I did that work prior to being a dad, because as a dad, I don't even know if I could stomach it. I wasn't a dad when I was in seminary. Child sacrifice, really? What is that? What God is like? What do we do with a story like this? This bothers you. If it bothers you, it should bother you. And the ways we've typically interpreted the story, not super helpful in it. Most of the time when I've heard this story kind of unpacked, the preacher or the teacher would typically take the story and then just bury the story in a mountain of cliche and metaphors. Like, what are your altars? What is God asking you to sacrifice? Right, that kind of stuff. Like, how is it that you can step forward in faith? And honestly, I remember sitting in a church. I was leading a college group, and I was sitting with a bunch of college students at a church. And the pastor was teaching on the story, and I had just kind of done the work on the story, and so I was excited to see what would happen. And he read through the story, and then he said, "You know, God needs all of us to sacrifice something that's standing in the way of us and God. I'm there for that." And then he put up on the big screen a plate of nachos, and he said, "Yeah, for me, it's nachos. I eat nachos. I know it's not good for my body, and I don't feel good after I eat nachos, and so God is asking me to sacrifice nachos." And I just remember feeling sick to my stomach, because I get it, cute metaphor, but in this story, Abraham's not asked to sacrifice nachos. He's asked to climb a mountain with his boy to build an altar, slit the neck of his son, and then lay him on the altar and light him on fire. That's different. That's not nachos. That's hard. So that's a problematic reading for me, just to bury it in metaphors and cliches. As well-intended as that is, I think it's problematic. It doesn't answer the question. The second way, I do think that tends to be good intended. The second reading of this that I think is an interpretation that is worse, more problematic than the first. And I think this one completely misses the point and is, in fact, quite dangerous. But some people have said, they read the story and then they say, well, you know what? This is just who God is. Who are you to question God? Are your ways higher than God? If he needs Abraham to sacrifice his son or to see if he's got it in him, then who are we to say anything else? Okay, the problem with that, if God is God, which is a ridiculous sentence because God is God. We know God is God. But if God is God, then God already knows that Abraham has what it takes, right? He already knows that Abraham has he already knows what's going to happen in the story. So why do it at all? And then if you chase that rabbit all the way, then it gets to the spot where it's like, okay, well, the only logical conclusion then is God must want it to happen. God must derive some pleasure off of Abraham going through the emotional anguish of it all. And if that's the case, see how dark that theology gets? That maybe God enjoys watching us suffer to see if we got, you know, how passionate are you? That is absolutely toxic, and yet I think for many of us, we were told that or bought that or maybe just inferred that a toxic theology that pictures God as like this grumpy old man on a cloud and he's just waiting to strike you down, and thankfully Jesus came to fix it, but like God himself is just this grumpy old man on a cloud, and maybe the only shot you have is at some point you die and you'll wait in a long line and Peter's like the bodyguard of heaven and maybe Peter will be nice. But God himself is kind of a monster. Like that's the conclusion we have. I would just argue that anytime you come into a problematic text like this, the first thing you have to run it through is, does this fit the character of God as revealed in Jesus? Because we are told again and again by every New Testament writer that if you want to understand God, you have to look to Jesus. Everything before Jesus, I love Paul. He says it's like a shadow. You can kind of understand some things from a shadow, but you can make a shape and form, but to know what the image is, you have to look to Jesus. And this idea that God derives pleasure in suffering looks nothing like Jesus. And when you bump into that, now you got to ask another question. What else is going on in the story that I just must be missing? What else? Because not only is this story, does that read of the story at least seem out of character for God, it is also out of character for Abraham, right? He doesn't even put up a fight. God says, sacrifice your son, and he says, okay, I'll go do it. He doesn't. Four chapters earlier, he's told that Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be destroyed. Four chapters earlier. He only knows a couple of people in Sodom and Gomorrah. The rest of Sodom and Gomorrah are complete strangers. But do you remember how when he's told that strangers are going to be destroyed, do you remember how he responds? This is Genesis 18, verse 24. What if there are 50, this is Abraham to God. What if there are 50 righteous people in the city? Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of 50 righteous people in it? God, far be it for you to do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating the righteous and the wicked alike. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth do right? You kind of get the passion of a man of faith here, right? Like you get a sense of who Abraham is, and he's not shy about it. God, why would you do this? This isn't who I know. You wouldn't do this, God. What if there are 50? And then if you keep reading, he's like, okay, God's like, okay. And he's like, well, what if there are 40? What if there are 30? What if there are 20? What if there are 10 righteous people? Abraham just, he argues with God. He confronts God. He questions God. And that is for complete strangers. So why is it that when it comes to his own son, we get crickets? Not one, no, really, God? You're going to ask me to do that? Not one. It is almost as though Abraham expects that this is going to happen. And I would argue that is, I think, what is going on here. Abraham is expecting this to happen. He's expecting God to take on the life of his son. He doesn't argue with him. He doesn't question him. Because in his mind, this is just the way things are. This is just the way God is. And that then raises the question, Why does he think that? And to get at that, let's do a little quick lesson in geography. Abraham is called, before the story takes place, he's in a place called Beersheba. He's going to leave Beersheba because God says, go to the mountain, I will show you Mount Moriah. So he's going to travel from Beersheba to Mount Moriah. It's quite the journey. He's going to travel there. And when he gets to Mount Moriah, by the way, Mount Moriah in modern day is this city. It's why it's hard to show on a map. Do you recognize the city? Say it loud and proud. Jerusalem. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Jerusalem. Wow. In like 1,200 years after the story, a king named Solomon, son of King David, he's going to build the first temple here. We read this in 2 Chronicles chapter 3. Verse 1, then Solomon began to build the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah. So here's where the geography comes into play. So we know the new city, there's still a city there. But if you go back to, let's go back to this picture of kind of what Abraham sees in his day, 1,200 years before Solomon will build that first temple. You've got a handful of distinct features going on in Jerusalem that I think are helpful to understanding the story. So this map works. The first is, so you can kind of see the Mount Moriah, and then this is just an AI recreation of the image, but something like this, you got the West Hill, the upper city, you got Herod's temple in the time of Jesus, Solomon's temple, and then probably some Canaanite stuff up here in the early story. But you have a couple of distinct valleys that are worth paying attention to. Actually, can we go back to the other image? It's a little bit easier to... Okay, so we've got a valley here. This valley is known as the Hinnom Valley. And then we have a valley over here known as the Kidron Valley. So Hinnom Valley... Oh, my laser pointer's dying. Hinnom Valley... Kidron Valley. This is a valley known as the Tyropian. It's probably not that steep, and it kind of got filled in later by rubble, but don't worry about that valley for now. But you got the Hinnom Valley and the Kidron. The Hinnom Valley kind of slopes around. It works for like a hot second. And kind of meets the Kidron like right in here. So we're going to swoop around and meet right there. Those two valleys are really critical to understanding the city of Jerusalem. I'm kind of in like full teacher mode from being on the land. So like this, let me try to show it. And I think our room is weirdly set up like the city of Jerusalem, kind of, if you use your imagination and stretch it a little bit. So so he's coming from Beersheba, which would be like on the stage, and he's heading in. Now, I'm gonna come down. If this is Jerusalem, you kind of got the Hinnom Valley that's going to come around like this. And you on this side, you've got the Kidron Valley, which is going to be like right here. Okay, does that make sense? So you have like two valleys and they kind of meet like somewhere in this spot right here. The Hinnom Valley becomes the Kidron Valley. Now, Jerusalem itself is set between two larger mountains. The mountain over here is a mountain known as the Mount of Olives. The mountain over here is a mountain often referred to as Mount Zion in our Bible. There are two bigger mountains. Psalm 121, David writes, I lift my eyes from Jerusalem. I lift my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. God places Jerusalem in, it's kind of like in a bowl. So David sits there and he realizes, God chose this land for us. And that's intentional because we're going to need to trust God. Normally in the ancient world, you're going to be wanting the highest land so you can see the enemy coming, but we can't see the enemy coming. They're coming up over a hill. We've got to trust God. So that's how they saw it. But over here, you've got the Mount of Olives. It's the last week in Jesus' life, especially the Mount of Olives is critical. Jesus is going to spend time in a place called Gethsemane. Shemanim means olives, and got means press. And so Jesus is in an olive press at the base of the Mount of Olives where he's squeezed like they would squeeze the olives. And that happens in the Mount of Olives. And then you have Jesus will come down and he'll enter the city. The city of Jerusalem, this would be like where the temple is. Chani would be like sitting right where the temple, the Holy of Holies, you're in the Holy of Holies seat. I looked earlier and I'm like, I'm glad she's in the Holy of Holies. So you got like your temple right here, okay? So temple's there, and then this is the Kidron Valley. Now on the other side, you've got the Hinnom Valley, and the Hinnom Valley is going to kind of slope around and meet. You got a big hill over here, and then this side is kind of like the West Hill right here where the rich are going to live. Does this make sense? Think geography a little bit. I don't know if that's helpful or if I just made it more confusing. The picture helps. Okay, now the Hinnom Valley in particular, so this particular valley, important to understand our particular story. The Hinnom Valley is, there's some stuff going on in the Hinnom Valley that is hard to really understand in our modern ears because it's so ugly. And by the way, if Moses or Abraham is coming from Beersheba and he's going to climb Mount Moriah, he is, unless he were to walk all the way around, which is silly, he is going to cross at some point through the Hinnom Valley to climb this mountain. So whatever's happening in the Hinnom Valley, he's experienced it. In fact, when Abraham is first called into the land, God says, walk the breadth of the land. So he's already seen what's happening in this particular valley because he's had to walk this valley before. But in this story, in order to climb that mountain, he crosses through that valley again. And that should ask, we should ask then the question, what is happening in the valley that might change how we understand the story? What does Abraham see that's happening in this valley? And the answer is disgusting. Let me read a couple of passages. This is from Jeremiah chapter 32, verse 35. They built high places for Baal in the valley of Ben-Hinnom to sacrifice their sons and daughters to Molech, though I never commanded, nor did it enter my mind that they should do such a detestable thing and so make Judah sin. So there is a god, it's a god of the Baals, a fertility god of the Baals, and the Canaanite gods, and apparently people in this valley are sacrificing their children to this god of the Baals. Now, and Jeremiah says, God would never think to do that. He would never think to ask that. Okay, interesting. But that's happening in the valley. This is not the only reference to what's happening in this valley with Molech in our Bible. It comes up a number of times. 2 Kings verse 23. He, that is King Josiah, desecrated Topheth, which was in the valley of Ben-Hinnom, so that no one could use it to sacrifice their son or daughter in the fire of Molech. Now, from ancient pictures of Molech, what you would do is, most of them are like, are from statues. We found one in Megiddo and a handful of other places, but it looks as though it's like a statue. It's kind of hard to tell, but we think it was like a statue with hands like this, and you would put your child in the hands of the god, as you saw him at least, pagan god Molech, and your baby would kind of roll into the flames. Disgusting, right? Never mind. I'm going to edit some things. And it actually gets even more disgusting than that, but that's kind of how it would work. And you find it again in Leviticus 18, verse 21. Do not give any of your children to be sacrificed to Molech, for you must not profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. And again, in Leviticus 20, you read that anyone who does this, correct them. This is so detestable that anyone who does this should be cut off from the community. And if they still insist on it, then you are to stone that person because this is such a detestable thing. God says, again and again, do not do this. But that was happening here. The sacrifice of children was happening in that particular valley. Now that raises the question, why would anyone think to sacrifice their child? It's not like pagans love their children less than religious people or than Christians. Like, people love children. Like non-Christians love their children too. So why would people sacrifice their children? Why do such a horrible, horrible thing? Now, to get at that, I need to give you the history of religion in 5 C's. This story, by the way, is going to completely jack up, like mess up everything people thought they knew about God. But up until this is how people thought about God. First C, we'll call it caveman. So there's a caveman somewhere, and caveman notices some things. Caveman notices that the rain comes from up. And the sun comes from up. And so caveman connects that rain comes from up, sun comes from up. Something about the forces that are up gives us food. Something about the forces that are up are responsible for crops and life, and we would not be here. When the rains don't come or when the sun is not sunning, we don't have food. So caveman notices that there's a force up there somewhere. Caveman also notices that that force is connected to her. She has like a cycle, a menstrual cycle, and that cycle seems to be almost perfectly in sync with the moon. And so the moon is up, the sun is up, rain comes from up, and so caveman begins to realize that the forces that control life are up. And somehow we need to keep those forces happy. Now in Canaan, where Abraham enters, the god, what they called that force in their mind was the Baals. Molech is one of the Baals. And somehow we have to keep the force happy because the force, thank you, you gave us life. However, what they realize is that same force could get angry with you. That's why it didn't rain this year. You didn't keep the force happy. So they called that force Molech. Different cultures called that force a different thing. But they said somehow we got to keep the force happy. That's C number one. C number two, how do we do that? We'll call that crops. Every year you get crops, and how do you make sure that the force knows that you appreciate the force giving you the crops? Well, one of the ways you can do it is by taking the very beginning of the crops, the first fruits of your crops, and you can offer it. You got to burn it because it has to go up. So you're going to burn it, and it's going to go up. And by burning it and sending it up, maybe it'll feed the force, and they'll realize, thank you, force. But what happens when you did that, and next year it didn't rain? Did we not offer enough? So the problem with the whole system up until this is you never knew if you did enough. Did I appease God enough? Did I satisfy the force enough? So what do you do if you've offered, you did crops, you did your first fruits, and then next year you gave even more crops? You got to give more. And so the third C, I'll call that cattle. What if we could offer an animal? What's more expensive than crops? Cattle. So what if we offered them cattle? Maybe even our firstborn cattle. If we could offer cattle, we could maybe keep the forces happy. But what happens if you offered your cattle and you gave your crops, you gave your cattle, and it still isn't raining, or you lost the life? Apparently that force is still angry with you. So what do you offer? We have historical record, fourth C, of humans saying, what if we offered our own flesh? What if we cut ourselves to show we are serious? We are serious. We know you're angry with us. Please forgive us. We're serious. Please forgive us. There's a story in your Bible. It takes place on Mount Carmel. And it's a story of the prophets of Baal. So the same kind of dudes. Prophets of Baal. And it hasn't rained. And so they're trying to get Baal's attention because it hasn't rained. And they've offered their crops and they offered their cattle. And we read this. 1 Kings 18. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. Baal, answer us, they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. And they danced around the altar that they had made. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. I like Elijah. He's like, shout louder, he said. Surely he is God. Perhaps he is deep in thought or busy or traveling. Maybe he is sleeping and must be awakened. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until the blood flowed, as was their custom. This is just how life was. The forces are angry, the gods are angry with you, and it has always escalated from crops to cattle to cutting your own flesh. Somehow you need to show the forces you mean it. I'm sorry. We didn't give you enough. We didn't trust you enough. Do you not see? We mean it. But what happens if even that, it doesn't rain? And you're now looking at the rest of your family and thinking, we're not going to make it. We got nothing here. What is the one thing left that you can offer that would show God you are serious? What is the thing in your life that is absolutely most precious to you? And this is true of them too. This is not just a modern thing. But what is the thing you could offer that meant everything to you? To show the gods that okay, we are serious. And their answer was, fifth C, your child. And not just your child, you're going to offer him your firstborn child, your future, your child. Abraham is told to go sacrifice his child, and he does not even put up a fight. It's as though he expects this to happen because this is what the gods demand. It's always been this way. No matter where you go, this is what's demanded of you. Here's the question, though, I think the story for me unlocks, at least. Is the primary point of the test, we're told it's a test, is it for God to discover something about Abraham's character? Or is the primary point of this test for Abraham to discover something about God's character? Does he need to like shake him loose to see something that's going to be true for him, has always been true for him, but he's so ingrained in this way of thinking that it has to kind of be a big moment or he's not going to get the message? I propose to you that that God doesn't need something to learn something about Abraham. I mean, he's God. He knows Abraham. But Abraham does need to learn something about God. And predominantly the thing he needs to learn about God is stop it. Stop it. This sacrificing your child thing, thinking that that's what I want, knock it off. I would never do that. Once again, Jeremiah says, I never commanded that. It didn't even enter my mind. They should never do such a detestable thing and make Judah sin. That was never my dream. I need to reset. We got to hold the power button down because somehow everyone everywhere thinks that's what I want. Whatever they call the gods, they think that whatever dark, demonic, weird stuff is going on, they have attached that to God, and that's not who God is. And Abraham, I need you to start showing people that. In fact, to give you a sense of just how ugly this is, that place, the Valley of Hinnom, or the Valley of Ben-Hinnom. In the Hebrew, it's the Valley of Hinnom. That's the Old Testament. The New Testament is written in Greek. And how do you say the Valley of Hinnom in Greek? Well, the word valley is the word gah, and the word Hinnom gets shortened to henna. So the word Valley of Hinnom in the Greek is Gehenna. Bible scholars, what word do we typically translate Gehenna as in English?
Hell.
Yeah. Yeah. This becomes the picture that Jesus will point to again and again. Do you remember what happened in that valley? Do you remember what happened in that valley? Do you remember what happened in the valley? That becomes the temporary picture for an eternal, like, you can't get uglier than that. You cannot get uglier than what happened in that valley. Do you remember what happened in the valley? It's as though Jesus again and again needs people, like, look in the valley. He's not like that. God has never been like that. He would never ask that of you. No more. No more. Stop. And that, for me, I find incredibly moving. Incredibly moving. Maybe we're thinking, like, why doesn't God just come out and tell Abraham that? Why go through the whole thing? Because that's a traumatic moment. Why make him go through the whole thing? Why do the whole test in the first place? Why not just tell Abraham, I'm not like that? And I propose to you that the reason we find this passage so barbaric is because this passage exists. Up until this point in history, it was assumed this is just what the gods demanded. Up until this point in history, this wasn't barbaric. This is just the way life is. We have a historical record from almost every empire around ancient Canaan of child sacrifice. Let me show you a map. Not that one. That one. In the Empire of Carthage, we have found thousands of infant bones. That is true for Phoenicia. That is true for Mesopotamia, especially where Abraham's from. They had a whole god named Nana, and this is what she required. And everywhere. So if you look to the west, you've got child sacrifice. You look to the east, you got child sacrifice. You look to the north, you got child sacrifice. You look to the south, you've got child sacrifice. Everyone, everywhere, this is kind of assumed. So why the test? I think Abraham needs to get woken up. I don't know that the messaging came through when God said it again and again earlier. I don't know that it came through. And I worry as a pastor, it's one of my favorite passages to preach because I think that this toxic theology is We would never say we got to sacrifice our kids, but I still think this toxic theology is something that people believe. I've watched parents say, I can't love my child because God said I can't love that child because of something that child did or something that child is. And think about how toxic that theology is. I've watched people go to their holy place, be it a church, a temple, a synagogue, a mosque, because they're afraid that God is against them, and they need to somehow win the approval back. We do this in our world, non-Christians and Christians. Somehow God is this detached force, and he's not listening, and if I can just do something to wake him up. We have people in our world that still cut themselves because they don't think they're valuable in the eyes of their God. And this story forces us to confront that. There are people in our world that are afraid. As a pastor, you hear that this is a joke, but under the joke, it's always some level of like, I've heard from people like, I can't go to church because if I were to step foot in a church, a lightning bolt will get me. Think about how, like, what kind of image of God? Is God cruel and vindictive? Is he out to get you? Is he angry with you? I don't think I'm exaggerating when I suggest that Jesus would say that that theology is from the pit of hell and uses that as the metaphor for this is where that theology takes you. We will go through heartache in life, every single one of us. Jesus will say that the enemy has come to kill, steal, and destroy, but God has come to give life. He has come to give life. When we go through heartache, it is not because God is mad at you. The reason your marriage didn't work out is not because God is angry with you. The reason you lost that child is not because God is mad at you. The reason why you every month stare at a pregnancy test and wonder why can't we get pregnant is not because God is mad at you or angry with you. The reason life sometimes falls apart, you watch a loved one go through the absolute worst, is not because God is angry with you or mad at you. This story, our theology matters. How we think about God matters. And as a church, as a community, I said every 5 years we at least got to hit the story because we have to reclaim the story because it shows us a pretty beautiful picture of God, but it's sometimes hard to see in the story. God will provide. That's where the story ends. Now, quick P.S., and this is a major one, though. It's a major P.S. Abraham says to Isaac, God will provide the lamb. For 1,500 years prior to this, what was Mount Moriah that'll become Jerusalem, thousands of lambs would be sacrificed every single year. And you even find this in the prophets. They say, God doesn't really need the lambs. This isn't. But thousands of lambs are going to be killed. And then Jesus is going to enter the story. And his cousin John's going to see Jesus and say, you know who he is? The Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And for 3 years, Jesus will do his ministry. And then on the last week, he's going to come down the Mount of Olives, cross, cleanse the temple. And then they're going to kill him for it. And they're going to kill him. Matt, raise your hand. So I'm going to run all the way down there. Yeah, somewhere right there. That's where they're going to kill him. Overlooking the Valley of Ben-Hinnom. And Jesus, after the blood has been soaked for thousands of years with the blood of animal sacrifices, because God said no kids, Jesus is going to hang from a cross there, and he's going to say, it's finished. It's done. He's not angry with you. That's good news. Would you join me in a word of prayer? Father, Lord Jesus, set us free. Set us free from whatever lies we were told, whatever hoops we were told we had to go through in order to make you happy or to be loved by you. Jesus, help us to see in your eyes the God who welcomed children into your arms, who welcomed prostitutes, tax collectors into your arms. Lord, help us to see a God who loves us. Lord, help us to see it. Help us to see it. Confront the ugliness in us. And Jesus, we want to look more like you because we, as I stand and think about what was happening in the valleys, Lord, I'm aware that but by the grace of God go I, and it Had you not won my heart, I could find myself doing the same things. And so, Jesus, we are so grateful for that and for resetting history. And Jesus, we pray this in your name. And everybody said,
for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church, we want to wish you a blessed week.